Good morning and welcome. My name is Lynn Curry. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I'm a member here at Prairie. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your sexual, color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. Later in the service, we will invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we can get to know you a little bit better. So we hope you won't be shy if you haven't been here for a while or are new. On Sunday mornings, please, if it's your first time, come back again. We provide a wide variety of services. Sometimes they're presented by a Prairie member and sometimes by a member of the wider community, as is the case today. Awesome. I'm going to welcome Margaret Moses up to share the opening words with us.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Margaret Moses. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. Today we celebrate a dream awakening. Today we worship with renewed hope in our hearts. Today we act on an audacity of hopes and dreams for the future. Today we begin the hard work for justice, equity, and compassion in all human relations. For today is a day like no other, and it is ours to shape with vision and action. Let us worship together and celebrate a dream awakening.
Now I'd like to welcome up Dan Proud to light the chalice for us.
Well, I'll read the words. We are lighting our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving. And in loving, may we find peace.
Okay, I'd love to introduce our speaker today. Today's presentation is about Bayard Rustin, as you can see there. Jacqueline Hauptmann is here with us today, one of the co-authors of the book. She is a freelance science writer and award-winning children's novelist, having written The Reinvention of Edison Thomas, published in 2010, and she's the co-author of Troublemaker for Justice, the story of Bayard Rustin, the man behind the March on Washington. I also got some inside information the other day that she's also a really amazing Zumba instructor. The two of our members, Karen and Jane, enjoy taking classes from. So welcome, please, to Jacqueline, sorry.
I think I'll stick with this microphone. Is that going to work?
Yeah. Let's move it to the side because people have a hard time seeing. So okay. We'll just. It's okay. Moving! Okay. Moving! Okay, there we go.
Does this work? Okay.
Otherwise, yeah, if you keep.
I think I'll just hold it. I think I'll just hold it.
Yeah.
Just look at me when I'm supposed to slide.
Okay. I'm just going to set my timer so that I don't go over. Okay, so tomorrow we are going to celebrate the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, but today I'm going to tell you about somebody else. And I'm going to start with a little passage from the book. There we go, that's right. On a hot August afternoon in 1963, Bayard Rustin stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. In front of him, a sea of people stretched all the way to the Washington Monument and along the reflecting pool in between. Some had even climbed the trees that lined the sides of the reflecting pool to get a better view. Although most of the people in the crowd were African-American like Bayard, people of all races stood together, some even holding hands. There was no whites-only section in this crowd. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. stood at the podium. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Then came Bayard's turn. He stepped out of the shadows to read the words he had prepared. This was Bayard's moment, but his name was not even printed on the official program of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Everyone knows about the I Have a Dream speech, but who knows what Bayard had to say that day. Today, Martin Luther King Jr. is a familiar name, but who remembers Bayard Rustin? Who remembers that he went to jail for opposing war? Who remembers that he helped teach King the value of nonviolence? Who remembers that he was arrested for sitting in the whites-only section of a bus 13 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man? Who remembers all the work he did fighting bigotry, segregation, militarism, and nuclear weapons? Who remembers that he organized the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, which had been the largest nonviolent demonstration for civil rights in U.S. history? Bayard Rustin was one of the most influential civil rights leaders, but very few people know his name. So. Next. Bayard Rustin was born in 1912 in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He was raised by his grandparents. His grandfather, Jennifer, was born into slavery. His grandmother, Julia, was a Quaker and an early member of the NAACP. She taught Bayard that that disputes should be settled nonviolently, but she was passionate about the struggle for justice. Next. Quakers believe that there's a bit of the divine in everybody and that each human being is of unique worth. This is why Quakers value all people equally and oppose anything that may harm or threaten them. Their testimonies include equality, that is, treating everyone equally, realizing everyone has gifts to share, peace and nonviolence, integrity, that is, telling the truth and doing what we say we will do, and simplicity, focusing on what is truly important and letting other things fall away. Next. In high school, Bayard excelled in academics, athletics, public speaking, writing, and singing, and in activism. He was arrested for sitting in the whites-only section of a local theater. Bayard attended a few years of college where he became committed to pacifism and his Quaker faith. He also realized that he was gay. He was relatively open about it at a time when people could be arrested for holding hands with someone of the same gender. He said, "My activism did not spring from my being gay or, for that matter, from being black. Rather, it is rooted fundamentally in my Quaker upbringing and the values that were instilled in me by my grandparents who reared me. Those values are based on the concept of a single human family and the belief that all members of that family are equal." Next. He moved to New York, where he sang at the Apollo Theater. He sang in a Broadway musical with Paul Robeson. In the 1930s, he joined the Young Communist League to work for social justice and end segregation in the military, but quit when the focus of the group changed to supporting the Soviet Union. That brief dalliance with communism began a lifetime of surveillance by the FBI. Next. He was hired by a pacifist organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation and traveled across the country teaching about peace, nonviolence, and social justice. He embraced Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolent direct action called Satyagraha, translated as insistence on the truth. Bayard used Richard Gregg's book, The Power of Nonviolence, to teach the philosophy of nonviolence and to train young activists. Gregg was a Quaker lawyer who had lived in India for 4 years, spending 7 months in Gandhi's ashram. The power of nonviolence comes from what he calls moral jujitsu, and here's how it works. If a protester is attacked and fights back, the attacker feels justified in using more violence. But if a protester responds to physical violence calmly, without fear or anger, and without fighting back, it throws the attacker off balance. The attacker is surprised and confused, not sure what to do. By not fighting back, the nonviolent protester shows that his belief in the cause is strong and that he respects the humanity of every person, even his attacker. The attacker uses a lot of energy and starts to feel uncomfortable, especially if there are witnesses. In 1942, as Bayard boarded a bus to Louisville, a young white boy reached out and grabbed Bayard's tie. The mother hit her son and used a racial slur. Bayard went to the back of the bus and sat down. And then here's a passage from the book. Suddenly inspired, Bayard rose from his seat and moved to the whites-only section. The driver told Bayard to move back. "My friend," Bayard replied, "I believe this is an unjust law. If I were to sit in back, I would be condoning injustice." The driver called the police, but Bayard would not budge. Even when the police arrived, he refused to move. The police beat him, dragged him off the bus, threw him on the ground, and kicked him. Using his training in nonviolence, Bayard didn't move, but let them kick him again and again. Then he stood up and said, "There is no need to beat me. I am not resisting you." As the other bus passengers looked on, the police put Bayard in the back of a police car and continued to kick him and call him names, trying to make him fight back, but Bayard stayed calm. At the police station, they pummeled him again, even ripping his clothes as they tossed him back and forth to one another. Bayard showed no fear, at least on the outside. Bayard's lack of resistance baffled the police, but it had inspired one of the white bus drivers to visit the police station and seek Bayard's release. The assistant district attorney questioned Byer for half an hour and decided not to press charges, saying, "You may go, Mr. Rustin." After this incident, Byer was even more convinced of the power of nonviolence to fight racial injustice. He had been released, a white bus rider had come to help him, and the district attorney had addressed him as Mr. Rustin. White Southerners never addressed African-American men as Mr. That incident occurred in 1942, 13 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat in Montgomery. Here's a quote. "I am a Quaker, and as everyone knows, Quakers for 300 years have on conscientious ground been against participating in war. I was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison because I could not religiously and conscientiously accept killing my fellow man. Even though he was granted conscientious objector status in World War II, he believed that alternative service supported the war, so he refused to report for his physical and served 2.5 years in federal prison. He continued his activism with efforts to desegregate the prison." Another quote from Byer. "I am an opponent of war and of war preparations and an opponent of universal military training and conscription. But entirely apart from that issue, I hold that segregation in any part of the body politic is an act of slavery and an act of war." Next. In 1947, Byard organized and participated in the Journey of Reconciliation, which was a model for the later Freedom Rides, which took place actually 14 years later. During the journey, you can see him in the middle there with the bow tie, and his friend George Hauser, who is the second from the right. Those two were the ones who organized it. So during the journey, he was arrested, and he was sentenced to 30 days on a chain gang.
Next.
Yeah, I don't remember if I put that slide in. Sure. Yes, I skipped that one. Okay. He published an account of his experiences there, which were pretty horrible, actually. And that was published in two different newspapers, and as a result, there was actually some prison reform in North Carolina as a result of the reaction to the horrible conditions that he publicized. next. So as I said, Byard was pretty open about his sexual orientation. His friends and his colleagues knew about it, but it wasn't public. But that changed in 1953 when he was arrested in Pasadena, California, on a charge of lewd vagrancy. He pled guilty to a charge of sex perversion, which was what they called consensual homosexual activity. But his sexual orientation was now public. As a result of the arrest, he was forced to resign from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Next. After a while, he became involved in the writing of the publication called Speak Truth to Power, A Quaker Search for an Alternative to Violence. It was a nonviolent response to increasing militarism and the threat of nuclear war. He was a major contributor, and he's credited actually with coining the term Speak Truth to Power, which we use a lot these days. Here's a little excerpt from that publication. "We speak to power in three senses. To those who hold high places in our national life and bear the terrible responsibility of making decisions for war and peace. To the American people, who are the final reservoir of power in this country and whose values and expectations set the limits for those who exercise authority. And to the idea of power itself and its impact on 20th century life. Our truth is an ancient one, that love endures and overcomes and that hatred destroys. That what is obtained by love is retained, but what is obtained by hatred proves a burden. This truth, fundamental to the position which rejects reliance on the method of war, is ultimately a religious perception, a belief that stands outside of history." So, as I said, Byard was a major contributor to this publication, and when it was published, there was a list of 13 authors, but Byard wasn't one of them. He felt that the arrest in Pasadena would detract from the effectiveness of the of the publication. And actually, in 2012, the publication was reissued with Byard's name included and with an apology. Next. So in December of 1955, Rosa Parks was arrested on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. and 26-year-old Martin Luther King Jr. became the leader and spokesman for the African Americans boycotting the Montgomery buses. In early 1956, things began to get tense. The White Citizens Council threatened the boycotters with death and firebombed the homes of boycott leaders, including Dr. King. In response, African American ministers and train workers smuggled guns to Montgomery activists. Armed guards patrolled the area around the homes of King and other leaders. Byard went to Montgomery to make sure that the protest remained nonviolent. When he arrived on February 21st, 1956, he described the situation as like war. Although Dr. King had studied Gandhi in graduate school, Byard discovered guns in Dr. King's house. He said that King had not been prepared for the job, either tactically, strategically, or in his understanding of nonviolence. So Byard got to work. He attended strategy sections. He ran workshops on nonviolence. He wrote protest song lyrics. He helped organize carpools. He wrote press releases and publicity materials. And he made concrete suggestions about acting in a Gandhian manner. Byard and King got along well, and Byard became a mentor to King, helping him understand how important it was for the boycott leader to be nonviolent at all times. If a leader's house is bombed and he shoots back, Byard told King, then that is an encouragement for his followers to pick up guns. King began to embrace pacifism as a way of life, not just as a useful tactic for fighting segregation on buses. He removed the guns from his house, disarmed his bodyguards, encouraged all boycotters to become nonviolent. The boycott became known across the world as a peaceful protest, and King developed a reputation as a nonviolent leader. Meanwhile, local police began watching Byard. A local newspaper spread a rumor that he was planning a violent uprising, that he was an outside agitator, a New Yorker, a communist. King and Byard agreed that it would be best if Byard left Montgomery before word got out of his 1953 arrest in Pasadena. Back in New York, Byard stayed in close contact with King. We couldn't put this in the book because I didn't have any confirmation of it, but the word is that he left Montgomery in the trunk of a car. So back in New York, he helped raise thousands of dollars for the boycott. He wrote speeches for King. He organized a huge New York City rally. After Montgomery's buses were integrated, Byard continued to be a mentor to Dr. King. Between 1957 and 1959, Byard helped organize three protests in Washington, D.C., which brought tens of thousands to the Capitol. Next. In 1963, a group of civil rights leaders began planning the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. It was clear that the only person capable of pulling it off was Byard. Here's what Byard accomplished in 8 weeks without computers or cell phones. His staff arranged for 1,500 buses, 21 trains, and 3 planes to bring people to Washington and leave on the same day. Every bus, train, and plane had a captain who kept track of those in their care and made sure to have first aid kits and extra water. Byard wrote press releases and detailed instruction manuals for marchers, bus captains, and drivers. Giant water tanks supplied 21 temporary water fountains. 200 volunteer nurses and doctors worked at 25 first aid stations. He also ordered 200 portable toilets. Next. This is my favorite one. 300 volunteers in New York used 5 tons of American cheese to make 80,000 sandwiches for sandwiches. And I just found this picture this week. It's an actual picture of them actually making the sandwiches. But perhaps most importantly, Byard educated participants about the need for nonviolence. Hundreds of African-American police officers were trained to be peacekeepers. They did not wear their uniforms and were armed only with walkie-talkies. Next. They had planned for a crowd of 100,000, but on August 28, 1963, 250,000 people converged peacefully on Washington. Byard knew that Dr. King was a powerful speaker, so he scheduled him last. He also knew that if anything went wrong, accidents, traffic jams, or especially violence, that the event could have ended before King got to make his speech, one of the most memorable in history. So I've been talking about civil rights, but there was a lot more. All through his life, Byard fought for peace and social justice. He was passionate about human rights for all humans. It didn't matter who was being discriminated against. All discrimination was wrong. If he was prevented from fully participating in the civil rights movement, he found another place to make a difference. He worked for the rights of workers and refugees. He fought against war and nuclear weapons. He worked for democracy and human rights all over the world, from Laos to Haiti to Poland to Zimbabwe. And see in the upper left corner, that peace sign there? That picture was taken in Aldermaston, England, at an anti-nuclear march, and that's the first appearance of that particular symbol. And Byard is credited with bringing it across the pond to the U.S. Next. In 1977, he met Walter Nagel, who would be his partner for the rest of his life. Walter encouraged Byard to work for gay rights, which he did, but he also said this: "If we want to do away with the injustice to gays, it will not be done because we get rid of injustice to gays. It will be done because we are forwarding the effort for the elimination of injustice to all, and we will win the rights for gays, or blacks, or Hispanics, or women, within the context of whether we are fighting for all." Byard passed away in 1987. At his memorial service, Byard's friend and now Congressman John Lewis said this: "Byard Rustin, oh, what a life." Next. What a life indeed. Byard was intelligent, eloquent, and charismatic. He was a strategic thinker and organizer. He was an important figure in the civil rights movement, yet few know his name today. That does not diminish his contributions. For every Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, there are thousands of people whose name will never appear in a history book. But they made things happen. When I speak to school groups about Byard, I get questions like, "I'm not Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or Byard Rustin. What can I do?" I tell them, you can find your own gifts. You don't have to be as accomplished as Byard to make a difference. Byard was Byard. You are you. It is up to you to find your gifts and find your way. Byard was very good at recognizing the gifts of others. When he put Rochelle Horowitz in charge of transportation for the March on Washington, she was shocked. She didn't even know how to drive. Byard replied, "My dear, you are compulsive. You won't lose a bus." Byard knew she would be able to handle all the details, and she did. So, yes, we need to remember Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. Yes, we need to remember Byard Rustin. But we also need to recognize that they didn't do it alone. There were thousands, millions of people working for justice. The people who walked to work during the Montgomery bus boycott, or those who drove carpools, the people who hand-cranked mimeo machines to make flyers, the people who rode around in cars with megaphones publicizing the march and handing out buttons. And those 300 volunteers who assembled 80,000 cheese sandwiches. Byard may have been invisible to many, but his influence is everywhere. And so is the influence of the activists who came before him, and the activists who worked with him, and those who learned from him, and those who followed in his footsteps. So I will leave you with these words that Byard wrote while he was in high school. "I ask of you no shining gold. I seek not epitaph or fame. No monument of stone for me, for man need never speak my name. But when my flesh doth waste away, and seeds from stately trees do blow, I pray that in my fertile clay you gently let a small seed grow. That seed, I pray, the evergreen, that in my dust may always be that everlasting life and joy you manifest in that green tree." Byard's work is not finished. It's up to us to continue the fight for peace and justice. And one of the reasons that we wrote this book for younger readers was so that it would be engaging and accessible to younger readers, but we're finding that adults are really appreciating the book because it's not that thick. Actually, that was his grandparents. His mother, Florence, was about 17 when he was born, and for the first 9 years of his life, he thought he was Florence's brother. Jennifer died early. Julia still, there are letters that she wrote to him while he was in federal prison, and she supported him in every way. No, he attended elementary and high school in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and he attended a few years of college at Wilberforce and Cheney State, and then a couple of classes at NYU. So the book started with Mike Long. Mike Long is an associate professor at Elizabethtown College. And he edited a book of Byard's letters. He edits and writes books about all kinds of social activists. He has one on Fred Rogers, Jackie Robinson. And in the process of writing that book, he had a young son, and he thought, well, you know, my son should be able to read about Byard as well. So he started to write this book. And he had worked with our other co-author, Walter Nagel, on the Book of Letters, because Walter was Byard's partner for the last 10 years of Byard's life. And he was also the archivist of the estate. So he has this huge resources of photographs and documents and audio tapes, too, which were really useful for me. So they worked together on that book. And they submitted it to Quaker Press, since Byard was a Quaker. And they thought, well, the content is great, but it's really not written for younger people. And I had recently given a talk at the National Gathering of Quakers about my novel. And so they knew that I was a Quaker who knew how to write for children. So they contacted me, and then I came on board as the third author.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline. Thanks.
Closing words today by Andrea Hawkins Camper will be shared by Suzanne Gernant.
May we see all as it is, and may it all be as we see it. May we be the ones to make it as it should be, for if not us, who? If not now, when? This is answering the cry of justice with the work of peace. This is redeeming the pain of history with the grace of wisdom. This is the work we are called to do, and this is the call we answer now. To be the barrier and the bridge, to be the living embodiment of our principles, to be about the work of building the beloved community, to be a people of intention and a people of conscience.
Thanks, everybody, for coming today. Please be sure to extend a hand of friendship to those around you. Greet your neighbor, drink some coffee, and then also please help us tidy up by putting away hymnals and things. Thanks.